From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Tap dancing was so out of fashion for a while, it was hard for Gregory Hines to find work. Now he's one of the reasons it's popular again. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the star of the films The Cotton Club, White Nights, and Tap. Iranian-born novelist Taghi Modaresi wants Americans to know more about his culture than the recent wave of Islamic fundamentalism. Coming up, we discuss his novel, The Pilgrim's Rules of Etiquette. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two recordings of compositions by Benjamin Britten. And Jeffrey Nunberg explains why we should come up with a better title for him than language commentator. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Bill Redlin. President Bush welcomed Canada's Prime Minister Brian Mulroney to Kennebunkport today to show off his vacation home and talk about the environment, trade, and the drug crisis in Colombia. The visit is billed as a private time for the two longtime friends, but National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft told reporters the two will no doubt exchange views on the political changes in Poland, the violence in Lebanon, and other issues. Mulroney brought his wife and four children for the two-day stay at the First Family's vacation home at Walker's Point. In welcoming his old friend, Mr. Bush talked about his love for the town where he has spent all but one summer of his life. A federal court jury today found Hotel Queen Leona Helmsley guilty of tax evasion and mail fraud, but the jurors acquitted her of the more serious charge of an extortion conspiracy. Jim Zaroli reports from New York.
Helmsley was convicted of 10 counts of mail fraud and 24 counts of tax fraud. Two former aides, Joseph Licari and Frank Turco, also were convicted of tax fraud. Scott Grayhead is with the New York Attorney General's office.
The verdict that the federal jury has rendered this morning sends a powerful message that big people and little people alike owe a duty to pay their taxes.
Helmsley became a national figure thanks to a series of magazine ads touting her as queen of her billionaire husband's hotel chain. After the verdict today, Helmsley was released on her own recognizance. She will return to the courthouse for sentencing November 14th. The charges carry with them maximum sentences of 3 or 5 years each. For National Public Radio, this is Jim Zaroli in New York.
Israeli Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin, in his first comments on the involvement of retired Israeli officers with the Colombian drug cartels, has branded the actions illegal and vowed to prosecute the offenders. Chris Hedges of the Dallas Morning News reports.
The defense minister said that the two private security firms being investigated worked in Colombia without permission and broke the law. Police have been questioning the employees of the two firms since Monday. They have impounded the passport of Reserve Colonel Yar Klein, who heads one of the firms. The second firm remains unidentified. The defense minister said the involvement of the two firms first became known to Israeli officials in April. Mr. Rabin said the defense ministry had warned Klein that his presence in Colombia was illegal. Mr. Klein says he was not involved in the training of hit squads for the drug mafia. He contends he was training Colombian farmers to protect themselves from terrorists. For National Public Radio, this is Chris Hedges in Jerusalem.
The State Department has condemned a serious shelling of a tanker carrying badly needed fuel supplies to Beirut. Spokeswoman Margaret Tuckweiler said the United States deeply deplores the attack and the loss of life among the crew. 7 crewmen were killed and 2 wounded. 2 others are missing and presumed dead. This is NPR News. Former Attorney General Elliot Richardson will monitor the Nicaraguan elections for the United Nations. He will be the personal representative of Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar. The United States was asked by Nicaragua to observe the electoral process, including voter registration. Voting has been set for next February. Richardson is best known for refusing to obey President Richard Nixon's order to fire Special Watergate Prosecutor Archibald Cox. Until last June, he was chairman of the UN Association of the United States. He is currently a partner in a Washington law firm. After a month's deliberations, a 19-nation conference in Cambodia has collapsed in Paris. This means a bloody 11-year-old civil war will go on. Here in Washington, the Bush administration blames the governments of Cambodia and Vietnam for the breakdown. Barry Schweid reports from the State Department.
State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler said the Vietnamese and the Hun Sen regime in Phnom Penh had refused to negotiate constructively on key issues. Prime among them was the composition of an interim government to take charge after Vietnamese troops leave Cambodia a month from now. Vietnam and the pro-Vietnam government in Cambodia had refused to give any role to the Khmer Rouge. Spokeswoman Tutwiler agreed the Khmer Rouge is a murderous group, and she said the U.S. is unalterably opposed to its return to power. But she said the Khmer Rouge could be part of a transition government. That's a touchy problem for the U.S., caused by the fact the Khmer Rouge is allied with Prince Sihanouk, the U.S.'s favorite Cambodian, and Sihanouk wants all anti-government elements in the transition. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
The Labor Department says Sara Lee Corporation has agreed to adopt a wide-ranging program to reduce the number of injuries attributed to repetitive motion and other hazards in meatpacking plants. The agreement will affect 8,000 workers at 31 Sara Lee meat processing plants in 20 states. The company also agreed to pay $20,000 in fines and drop appeals of four citations issued in November by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. I'm Bill Redlin in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. The film Tap has recently come out on video. My guest is the star of Tap, actor and dancer Gregory Hines. The film is about an ex-convict who's also a former hoofer. Gregory Hines is at the forefront of the recent Tap revival. He's been dancing professionally since the age of 5, when he teamed up in an act with his brother Maurice, who he performed with for the next 25 years. Hines starred on Broadway in Yubi, Coming Uptown, and Sophisticated Ladies. He broke into movies with roles in Wolfen and the Mel Brooks comedy History of the World Part 1. In the film The Cotton Club, he had a starring role as a hoofer. He co-starred with Mikhail Baryshnikov in White Nights, with Billy Crystal in Running Scared, and with Willem Dafoe in Off Limits. Gregory Hines started tapping as a young child.
My parents gave my brother and I, my brother Maurice and I, tap lessons. Like parents give their children piano or saxophone, just something to round them out. And in those days, this is like the late 40s, I actually began at 2.5. I can't imagine what I was doing at 2.5, probably just hopping up and down. But this is the family legend. I don't really remember not dancing. We took group classes at the local tap school. Somebody came by offering free lessons, and we got involved, and we liked it, and we seemed to show a little ability. So at that point, my parents found Henry Letang, who then really taught us how to dance.
I should mention he's a choreographer for your new movie as well.
Yes, he is.
Whose idea was it for you to perform professionally at such a young age? I think, was 5 the age when you started actually performing?
Yes. I think that it was just a group decision. Henry and my parents, and I suppose some of the members of the family. In those days, tap dancing was still very highly respected and an area that a lot of people wanted to be in. And the Nicholas brothers were big stars at that time, and it was Henry's contention that we would be the second coming of the Nicholas brothers. And in fact, my brother and I patterned ourselves after them. I latched on to Harold, and my brother used his hands and danced like Fayard, and so we just started working. I mean, it was there was work, and you know, we were cute, and we could dance, and we enjoyed it.
Did you do acrobatics like the Nicholas Brothers?
A little bit, but in no way did we compare to the Nicholas Brothers in terms of the kind of acrobatic things that they were doing. We did some flips and some knee drops, we called them in those days. That's where one leg is straight and the other leg is slightly bent. Nicholas Brothers used to do complete splits, but we weren't... our style wasn't into acrobatics. We were more tap, mostly tap and a lot of syncopated combinations.
When you were performing as a child, who kept the money?
What money?
You didn't make money when you were performing?
Well, we made money, but not much. I mean, in those days, there really wasn't much money, and it was beginning to diminish as we were performing because tap dancing was beginning to go out. So there really wasn't a lot of money. I think some of those early jobs, maybe we made $25
mm-hmm.
for, what was known as a club date. I remember New Year's Eve was a big night, and that performers would get paid double. So maybe New Year's Eve we'd get $50 for a club date, but there really wasn't a lot of money.
Was tap something that set you apart when you were a kid in school?
Not really, because we were professionals and from time to time had to go on the road to work, we went to professional children's schools. So I went to school with people like Patty Duke and Sal Mineo.
No kidding, really?
Sandra Dee. Yeah, and so, you know, we were just another professional. You know, we were just in school with, you know, kids that could relate.
Now, you did the Ed Sullivan Show when you were pretty young, right?
Yes.
How did he introduce you? What did he say?
You know, I don't remember. The only thing I remember about that is that in those days we used to wear a lot of grease on our hair. Because the only way to get respect in those days was to have slick down hair. And I remember after one of the shows, as we, you know, Ed, we did our number and we came over and Ed thanked us and we took a bow and he actually put his hand on my head. And I remember just for a moment the shocked look on his face when he realized that he had at least an ounce of grease on his hand. And I thought, well, this is it. We'll never be on this show again.
And were you?
Actually, we did it one more time, but he didn't put his head on my head the second time.
You had been dancing with your brother for many years. When you were 18, your father joined the act, and the act was named Heinz, Heinz, and Dad. At the age of 18, would you have preferred to be on your own with just your brother? Were you glad that your father joined?
I was. And at that point, it was... my father had been a musician for years, and he would be traveling in one direction, and my brother and I and my mother would be traveling in another direction professionally. And my father wanted the family to be together. And also, he felt that he wanted to show a family working together in a cohesive way. This was during the time when the black family and the was coming under a lot of scrutiny. You know, this was way before the Huxtables, where people, you know, had images where they could feel good about the black family and good about themselves. And so Heinz, Heinz, and Dad was really my father's dream in a way. And I liked it. I enjoyed it. Those were good years.
So he played and you danced?
Right. And then he would come down and do a number with my brother and I.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the 1960s, when you were performing as a family, there was really no vaudeville. There were few Broadway tap dancing musicals. Where did you perform?
Mostly nightclubs and lounges in the mid-60s, we worked Las Vegas lounges and all over the country, different lounges. And then we worked at the Playboy clubs. The Playboy clubs in those years was like vaudeville in that there was a club in each city around the country, and performers could work. There wasn't much money in it, but it was an opportunity to keep working every week and get better at one's craft. And then... in the late 60s, we made a transition to main rooms, and we began opening for stars in main rooms around the country.
How did you like that atmosphere? Did you like the showbiz atmosphere?
I did. You know, I grew up in that kind of atmosphere, and I felt very comfortable there and around musicians and other artists and, you know, getting a chance to work with people that I admired. I remember once we opened for Ella Fitzgerald, and it was, I mean, I was just so happy to be working with Ella Fitzgerald. We were opening for her, but Ella stipulated in her contract that we would get the same size billing on the marquee outside, and it was just such an honor to work with Ella Fitzgerald. One night we were working with her, and Cary Grant came running backstage and gave Ella Fitzgerald a big hug. And I mean, you know, it was a terrific experience just to be around a lot of these people, and I learned a lot.
Let me ask you, in the late 60s, when a more radical black consciousness was forming, was tap considered politically retro by people who you knew?
Well,
I'm just wondering, because there was a period when tap had a kind of reputation for being a timing kind of performance.
Well, there was a group of people that felt that way, but by that time, tap dancing had really gone out,
and
it really wasn't possible to make a living at tap dancing anymore. And in fact, Heinz, Heinz, and Dad, we had stopped tap dancing, and we were doing jazz dances and popular dances of the time in the act. We just, I mean, people just weren't doing it anymore, so we just discontinued it. But there was a group of black people who felt that it wasn't a good image to be seen tap dancing.
Why not? I mean, where did that come from?
I think that at that time, black people were really beginning to feel good about themselves and in an effort to feel as good as possible, we're looking at all the aspects of black art and black entertainment and trying to get rid of anything that they felt was stereotypical. And so tap dancing was one of those things, and it just, you know, it got caught up in that wave. And, I understood it. Even though I had been a tap dancer, I understood it. I remember growing up watching Amos and Andy, and I always loved Amos and Andy. But at that time, they felt that there were a lot of people who felt that Amos and Andy was not a good thing. And so there was a big campaign to get it taken off the air, and I understood that also.
Did it get to you at all personally?
Not really, because at that point, I mean, we had just discontinued tap dancing.
And I see, right.
Uh-huh. I just figured, that was it for tap dancing.
Mm-hmm.
Not only because of the way a group of black people felt, but also because in the entertainment business, it wasn't a viable way to make a living anymore.
So that's why you gave it up in around 71?
Right.
Well, I want to talk with you about what happened during that interim when you gave up tap dancing for a few years. But first we're going to take a short break, and my guest is dancer and actor Gregory Hines, who stars in the new movie Tap. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Dancer and actor Gregory Hines is my guest. He starred in the Broadway musicals UB, Coming Uptown, and Sophisticated Ladies, and in the films Wolfen, The Cotton Club, White Nights, Runnin' Scared, and Off Limits. His new film is called Tap, and it features not only him, but many other tap dancers. And Gregory, welcome back.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
we were just talking about how you gave up tap in 71, about how you thought that there was really no place to perform it anymore. You moved to the West Coast for a few years. Did you stop dancing altogether, or did you just give it up professionally?
Well, what happened was that at that point, the act, Hines, Hines, and Dad, I was beginning to question a lot of things at that point in my life. I was married to my first wife, and we had a daughter, and we had a nice apartment, and we had a car and a dog, and I was miserable. I was very unhappy, and it wasn't so much the marriage and my wife's fault. It was me, and I just had a lot of problems and a lot of questions. I think some of it was due to the fact that I had really been working from the time I was 5 years old, and had been in a situation where everybody was making decisions on what was going to be, and I always had somebody buffing between me and what was really happening, my parents, my manager, my agent, my publicist, my businessman. So at that point, I wanted to stop. The act broke up, and I moved to Venice, California, and I was a hippie for 5 years. And, it was that time of turn on, tune in, drop out, free love, and I thought to myself, yeah. I want to do that.
When you were doing all of that, did you tell people that you used to be in showbiz, or did you keep that to yourself?
Well, I was still in it in a way. I played guitar and sang in a jazz rock band called Severance. And it was just one of the most growthful times in my life. I discovered the joys of being a father. My first wife and I developed dynamic ways to co-parent our daughter, Daria, and she would live with me for 3 months in Venice, and then she'd go and live with her mother for 3 months on the East Coast, and that was just a terrific time. I met the woman that I'm married to now, and I learned how to take care of myself. For the first time in my life, I was on my own, and I learned how to really take care of myself and my daughter, and enjoyed playing with the band, and just it was terrific.
What got you back into dancing again?
Well, in 1977, at that point, my daughter was in the first grade, and it really wasn't the right thing to do to pick her up every 3 months and take her out of her schedule. So she was living in New York with her mother, and I thought I was going to be able to get by with 6 weeks during the summer vacation and alternate Christmases, but I just it just didn't feel right. I felt like I was losing touch with her. So I decided to move back to New York and see what I could get into. And the very day that I moved back, my brother had his agent submit me for a musical that was auditioning. And, you know, when I talk about this, it sounds like a corny B-movie. But, I mean, this really happened. And I went to the audition. It was called, the musical was called The Last Minstrel Show, which, in fact, it turned out to be the very last minstrel show because it closed in Philly. But I got it. I went and auditioned, and I got a part in it. And the next day, when I found out I had gotten it, my brother's agent told me that I got it on the strength of the fact that the director choreographer knew that I could tap dance. Now, at that point, I hadn't had on tap dance shoes in about 8 years. And so I ran out and bought a pair just to see if I could still do it. And I got back into it. And once I started dancing again, I remembered how much I loved it and that I missed doing it.
You had to buy a pair of tap shoes? You didn't even have any left?
No. I had cut it loose. And naturally, when I dropped out, I threw out, you know, everything.
Well, you did several musicals, UB, Coming Uptown, Sophisticated Ladies. You started making films as well. I think your first film was Mel Brooks' History of the World, Part One.
Well, that was the first film that came out. Actually, I had made Wolfen before that, but Wolfen was at that time mired in a lot of post-production problems. But it's true, History of the World, Part One came out first. And, you know, once I got into The Last Minstrel Show and it closed, I got very aggressive at that point because all of a sudden I was getting a paycheck and I liked it. And I, you know, on a good week in Venice, in the Venice days, I made maybe $40 a week. And here I was, I think I was clearing like $275, and I was able to buy my daughter a dress and go out for dinner and send for Pamela, who at that time, you know, we were still going out, but she would come and visit. And it was great. So I got very aggressive, and, you know, I developed the ability to be aggressive right up to the point of being obnoxious.
What's one of the most aggressive things you did to get a role in a movie?
I barged into Robert Evans's home, and I was trying to get into the Cotton Club, and I had a lot of conversations with him already, and he was, you know, he knew that I was hounding him. It was like a reign of terror that I had instituted against him. And I barged into his home, and I had my hair slicked back, and I had on like a 40s suit, and he was in his living room reading, and I just came in and I shoved everything off of his coffee table and got up on his coffee table and danced. And after I danced, I said, you know, and that's why I should be in this movie. And then I left.
How did you get into his house?
Well, I had been there a couple of times. So, you know, I showed up, and the guy, his butler, I guess, he came to the door, and he said, is Mr. Evans expecting you? And I said, expecting me? I said, you know, we have a meeting. He didn't tell you? So he let me in.
Very clever. How did you learn to act? I mean, you danced all your life. You'd been performing all your life, but you hadn't been acting.
No. You know, it was just in the doing of it, and one of the most fortunate things that happened to me in my career was that my first film, Wolfen, the star of the film was Albert Finney. And I can't say enough about Albert and the way he helped me in that film, because the director, Michael Wadley, it was his first feature, and he wasn't the type of director then who would come up to actors before takes and talk to them about motivation and the character and what might be happening. And many times at the beginning of a scene, I just didn't have the slightest idea what to do. I was just concentrating on my words so that I would know what to say. And every time Albert would come over to me and he would just make suggestions to me, you know, like 5 minutes before we were ready to shoot. And it just, I mean, it made my performance, because I really didn't know what to do. And Albert really helped me. And every time I see him, I just feel so warm towards him, because he really turned me on to acting and ideas and how to do it.
Have you ever used your dance experience to help you in a stunt?
Many times. I mean, I like to do stunts, and I've done a lot of them in my films, and I have a stunt double who I've worked with in every film, really, that I've had stunts, a man named Greg Elam, and he's worked with me a lot, and anytime I have to do something that appears risky, he'll go up and test it or somehow test the rigging, and it looks to me like he's actually trying to fall. You know, he just really tests it good, and so I feel pretty secure when I do it. And he also, you know, he's able to, if I get up to do a stunt and I get frightened, he can let me down easy. He does, because, you know, stunts is a very, like, macho thing. And some people do stunts when they don't even want to do them, but it's hard for them to get up there and say, well, I don't think I want to do it. And Greg has, you know, been really good about that. So I've been able to do stunts and sometimes do some that I was a little bit frightened of, but Greg got me through them. And sometimes I was going to do some and he just wouldn't let me, or would say, you know, I think I'd rather you not do it.
Well, I have one other dance question to ask you. I've noticed that frequently when you're dancing, you're looking down, mm-hmm. and I was wondering if you're looking at your feet.
Not actually at my feet. Sometimes I look at my feet, but not actually. Just I'm not sure what I'm looking at, and a lot of times when I'm dancing, I'm somewhat unaware of what's happening around me, and I'm not really focused on any one thing. It's just I guess it's just an idiosyncrasy that I have. I don't know. It's a strange feeling. Sometimes when I see a film of myself dancing, I wonder, you know, what's going on, or what was going on, or where I was looking.
Is it a stylistic thing, the difference between looking down and looking straight ahead?
I think so. You know, when I was a young boy coming up, there was a big emphasis on, you know, looking at the audience and performing and smiling, and I did it for a while, and then I didn't feel comfortable. I felt like it just felt like I was working too hard to perform, and it just seemed to me that I wasn't able to get into what I was doing. I was performing more for the people as opposed to trying to really enjoy my dancing and try to say something. And so as I grew older, I just got out of that and just developed into the style that I have now.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.
Gregory Hines stars in the film Tap, which has just come out on video. On September 18th, Hines will perform at Carnegie Hall in an evening of dance with stars from the film Tap and from Broadway's Black and Blue. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, physicist and science writer James Treffel. He's written more than 10 books about physics, including his latest, Reading the Mind of God in Search of the Principle of Universality. The New York Times has said that Treffel can describe the history and philosophy of science humorously, anecdotally, and yet profoundly. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The protagonist in the new novel, The Pilgrim's Rules of Etiquette, is an Iranian professor so immersed in history and the literature of the past that he ignores the horror of his country's present war with Iraq. Coming up, the author, Iranian-born novelist Taghi Modaresi, tells us how he's coped with events in his native country. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two recent reissues of Benjamin Britten conducting his own works. We're having a bit of dissension in the ranks here at Fresh Air when it comes to job titles. Jeffrey Nunberg says I should stop identifying him as language commentator. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney and his family arrived in Maine this afternoon for an overnight visit with President Bush. It's the third personal meeting between the two leaders. Tom Verdi of Maine Public Radio reports.
President Bush has known Prime Minister Mulroney for a number of years. After elections in Canada in November, President-elect Bush made it a point to call the Prime Minister-elect Mulroney to congratulate him. And the first foreign visit of his presidency was to Canada. Although the trip is an unofficial one for Prime Minister Mulroney, it is expected that the two leaders will talk about issues such as the free trade agreement and acid rain. The administration has made it clear that such cross-border problems as pollution and drug trafficking are of vital interest to both countries. The issue of other governments, including Canada, providing aid to fight drug trafficking abroad had been raised at the economic summit in Paris last month. And National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft told reporters yesterday this strategy might be another topic for discussion between the two leaders. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Verdi with the president in Kennebunkport.
In Colombia, three more judges have resigned after threats were made by drug czars trying to stop a government crackdown. Drug cartels have said that they will kill 10 judges for every Colombian extradited to the United States to stand trial on drug charges. 10 cities in Colombia have nighttime curfews now after a series of bombings. And the U.S. government has ordered families of its embassy staff in Colombia to leave, apparently because of fears of attacks by drug cartels. Strikes continue in the Soviet Republic of Moldavia as different nationalities fight to prevent passage of a new law making Moldavian the state language. NPR's Ann Cooper has more on the story.
80,000 workers have now joined the walkout to protest proposed requirements that they learn to speak Moldavian. The language issue has become a bitter fight between Moldavians, who are two-thirds of the local population, and minority populations, who want Russian to remain the language of everyday communication. Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev personally intervened in the fight today with a phone call to the Moldavian Communist Party chief. The Moldavian legislature continues debate on the proposal tomorrow. Strikers have vowed to remain off the job unless the legislature gives equal status to the Moldavian and Russian languages. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
Israeli Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin says reports of ties between Israelis and Colombian drug lords are overblown, and only one of two companies may have violated the law. There have been news reports alleging that former Israeli army officers gave paramilitary training to assassination squads for drug cartels in Colombia. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up 1.5 points. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Benjamin Britten was one of the major opera composers of this century. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of two compact disc reissues of two very different Britten works, the gently satirical Albert Herring and the tragic Billy Budd.
The invention of the phonograph has given us a priceless reference library of composers conducting or playing their own works. Nearly every major composer of this century, from Debussy and Ravel to Schoenberg and Shostakovich, has been lured into the recording studio. But the two composers whose performances have been most systematically preserved for posterity are Igor Stravinsky and Benjamin Britten. Britten's recordings have sometimes been hard to find in America, but London Records has been gradually reissuing them on CD. One of Britain's strongest operas is his version of Herman Melville's last story, Billy Budd. His librettists are Eric Crozier and no less a master than E.M. Forster. Britain often presents personal conflict in a larger social context. In Billy Budd, that society is the crew of the British warship Indomitable. The opera overflows with their songs, jaunty, haunting, rolling like the sea itself. Britain tends to choose stories in which the innocent are as efficiently destroyed by the self-righteous as by the forces of evil. Melville's tale is about a young British merchant sailor who was impressed into the British Navy during the Napoleonic Wars. His innate goodness arouses the irrational hatred of John Claggart, master at arms, who, like Satan or Shakespeare's Iago, plots against him. Caught in the middle is the stern yet thoughtful Captain Fairfax Vere, whose names literally mean be fair and truth. Claggart provokes the Christ-like Billy to strike him, and although Vere loves Billy, he must condemn him to be hanged for murder. In the opera's epilogue, the aged Captain Vere contemplates both his guilt and the incomprehensible feeling of benediction Billy has left him with. The part of Vere was written for Britain's longtime companion and collaborator, the extraordinary British tenor Peter Pears. If Billy Budd is a tragedy of innocence betrayed, Albert Herring is a comedy of innocence misplaced. The title role, also written for the versatile Peter Pears, is the mother-dominated greengrocer of a small and small-minded English market town. The town worthies must select the annual May Queen, but the only certifiable virgin is Albert, who, to his mortification, is crowned May King. He loses his status, as it were, after someone pours rum into his lemonade. At the end, his friends rejoice as he chucks away his orange blossom wreath. These are, of course, definitive performances, with superb supporting casts and splendid orchestral playing, all under the loving guidance of one of the century's greatest conductors, Benjamin Britten. An added bonus on the Billy Budd album are two Britten song cycles that also deal with large spiritual and moral issues, the Holy Sonnets of John Donne and Songs and Proverbs of William Blake. Peter Pears and Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau are the respective singers, with the composer himself at the piano.
When the stars threw down their spears and watered heaven with their tears.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Benjamin Britten's Billy Budd and Albert Herring on London Records.
Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night. What immortal hand or eye there frame thy fearful sight?
This is Fresh Air. Taghi Modarresi's second novel, The Pilgrim's Rules of Etiquette, is the story of an Iranian professor. He's a scholar of Iranian history and literature written in now dead languages. Because he lives in the wisdom of the past, many of the events of post-revolutionary Iran have not registered on him. Novelist Taghi Modarresi grew up in Tehran and came to America in the 50s to continue his medical studies. He now teaches at the University of Maryland School of Medicine and lives in Baltimore with his wife, the novelist Ann Tyler. I asked Modarresi why he left his mother and younger brother in Tehran and came to America.
When I finished my medical education in Iran, I went south to the south of Iran to do a research on some tribes and their ceremonial, ritualistic life. And there I found that I was being watched and interrogated by the Shah's Savak. And that left me with some horrifying feeling. I was mortified. That's strange to say that, but I thought I was completely undressed, stripped of all dignity I had. So I came back to Tehran, and I felt very, very depressed at that time. At that time, my brother said, "Why don't you come here and finish your specialty?" I wanted to be a psychiatrist and a psychoanalyst, so I came to this country.
I think many Americans know what they know about Iran through the Ayatollah Khomeini, through the hostage taking, through the Salman Rushdie affair.
Yes.
Do you feel that your culture is being misunderstood because of current events?
Oh, I'm glad that you asked this question, because that's the central issue that I love to talk about. But yes, indeed, that's true. I think I wrote the book with the hope that this is a small effort in presenting our culture in a way that is understandable by the Westerner Americans here. I hope the book shows that people there are ordinary people. They have certainly a very old culture, complicated, different, but the experience is human, as universally human as anything can be.
I think that now many of us feel we're seeing a side of Islam that is showing fundamentalist tyranny. You say when you were growing up that Islam gave you a sense of a stable world and a hopeful future.
Oh, definitely so, because as I was raised in a religious family, and I remember from very early period of my life, we were taught, and no, teaching is not a good word for it. We were exposed to the to a moral culture which wasn't that restrict. It was simple thing like being kind and considerate and be generous and not boastful, things like that. But more important, it was exposure to the culture through poetry. I still remember my mother reciting poetry. You know, Nizami is my favorite poet, classic Persian poet, whose verses still rings in my ear, and it sounded like running water to me. It still does. And telling stories in verse, which might be kind of strange for this culture, but in back home it was like fairy tale, and evoked vivid imagery. It's a beautiful magic of words.
You quote a lot of Persian verse in your book. Would you quote something? An excerpt of a poem that you feel has been very influential on you? One that you may or may not have included in your novel.
Okay, yes. This is from Sa'di. I just say it in Persian because I think the rhyme and the rhythm is conveying meaning in itself, which is quite different than poetry in English. Although there is some validity for that in English too, but it's quite different. Now, this is Sa'di is describing how a caravan is going away, and with going away, he sees his soul departing from his soul because his beloved is also going with that caravan. Well, it's so simple and sappy in a certain way, but it's not when you read it in Persian. And I want to quote that. Would you like to hear it?
Yes, please.
A caravan of histeran karam janam miravad. Van del ke ba khod dashtam ba del satanam miravad. Dar raftan jan az badan guyand har noi sohan. من با دو چشم خیشتن دیدم که جانم می رود.
That's really beautiful. Did what language did you write The Pilgrim's Rules of Etiquette in first?
Persian, Farsi.
Mm-hmm.
And then I translate that.
Do you find that you still think in Farsi, even though you've lived in America and you've spoken English for, well, I guess about 25 years?
Yes. Well, that's true. See, writing for me is a way of discovering a voice within me, and it is true that I can tell you what I want or what I think or how I go about my business in English, but when I want to write, I like to take off. And not to be concerned about my grammar or pronunciation, and that comes from within my soul, I suppose, and so I cannot do it in any other way, and yet I really like very much to be able to do it in English, but that's beyond me. I cannot do it.
But you translate your books into English.
That's different. Because then I have every piece there, and then it is a matter of polishing. It's just like doing mosaic work, that you put different pieces of the stone together and you polish it and polish it and polish it. That's different. And of course, for that too, I have to find a voice, almost like a rhythmic chanting. So I can put the sentences together. But when I have the original Persian text, and then I'm alone, and I'm not afraid of making mistakes, and then I'll do that. again and then again, and word processor is just a marvelous device.
Are you still practicing Muslim yourself?
No.
When did you stop?
Oh, way back when I was 15 years old.
So it's more of a cultural than a religious factor in your life?
Yes. I think it's part of my culture. That's exactly true.
Mm-hmm. Now, you teach at the University of Maryland. You're the director of the Center for Infant Study.
That's right.
At the University of Maryland School of Medicine. How does that part of your work relate to you as a novelist?
Oh, I think very much so. What I discovered through gradually in my professional life is that I'm very much interested in the languages, not just the ordinary language, but the way people communicate. And, of course, infants are the fascinating individuals because they communicate so well, and yet we do not know how they communicate. You hold a baby right away, you know whether he's saying he's unhappy or sad or angry or pleased or melt in your arm or something. So to learn that language, I think, is a very important part for me, especially for a person who is living in a culture which is different from his original culture, to learn the ways of life. You have to learn another language.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me.
Dr. Tagi Modaresi, his novel The Pilgrim's Rules of Etiquette is published by Doubleday. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
NPR's Alex Chadwick tonight has the first of his reports from Poland on the beginning of the Second World War. I'm looking forward to hearing that. And also a story that I've already heard because I did quite a bit of work on it, a report about the lighthouses of Maine, mostly stories and sounds of lighthouses from the Maine coast. And we did this story, Terry, in digital stereo, and we mixed it on a computer, did the editing and the mixing on a computer. The story has never been on regular analog tape. It's all on digital.
So that means it's not on reel-to-reel. You didn't use a razor blade to edit, which is what we're all used to doing.
Right.
In radio, was it really different for you to do this piece?
Quite a bit different. And the sound, it's difficult, but the sound is crystal clear.
Well, can't wait to hear it. Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. We've been referring to linguist Jeffrey Nunberg as our language commentator for a couple of years now. So now he tells me he's unhappy with the title.
We have to do something about this job description. Part of the problem is that verb to commentate. It's been around since the 18th century, but it's not a word that the English-speaking peoples have ever really taken to their linguistic bosoms. Just try dropping it into a conversation. As I was commentating just last week, you feel as if the title commentator ought to be reserved for people who have something terribly consequential to say and the voice to say it with. Whenever I hear myself introduced as a language commentator, I expect to hear one of those over-the-hill anchormen who comes on at the end of the show for 3.5 minutes of sonorous bombast. It is the best of words, it is the worst of words. One question is, how come I have to be a commentator when most of the other people in these slots get to be critics? After all, the field of criticism is a lot less exclusive than it was in the 19th century, when Matthew Arnold gave his famous definition of criticism as a disinterested endeavor to learn and propagate the best that is known and thought in the world. You'd have a hard time stretching that to cover some of the current run of fashion critics, music video critics, restaurant critics, and wine critics, not to mention Joe Bob at the drive-in. It's not clear what distinguishes a critic from a reviewer nowadays, except that reviewers don't say, as it were. In fact, we do have language critics around, though we don't usually call them that, maybe because language is only metaphorically a consumer item. But there are people who review the new words as they come out. The only difference is that the language critics aren't allowed to like anything. There are well-known cases of movie and book critics who've been fired because they gave too many bad reviews. But people like Edwin Newman and John Simon write whole books about language and never find a single nice thing to say about any expression. Now, I'm not averse to trying my hand at this sort of thing once in a while. Here's the wrap-up on this week's new words. World-class, adjective, an overused, pretentious phrase that suffers from a harsh cluster of five medial consonants. I give it 1/2 star. Prioritize, verb. I found this one a pointless sequel in the Eyes series, which brought us such turkeys as finalize, concretize, and incentivize. Save your larynx. Nunberg, Fresh Air, National Public Radio. There's always been an audience for this, a vast public who like to think that the English language hasn't come up with any good new expressions since Zounds and Bodkin. In fact, there's actually a word for this attitude. It's called pejorism, the philosophical doctrine that holds that everything is always going to hell in a handcar. A pessimist says that things are bad, a pejorist adds, you ain't seen nothing yet. It's a terrific word, which I've been trying to sneak into an article for about 10 years now, but the editors keep telling me it's too obscure. You heard it here first. But it takes dedication to maintain this level of sourness week after week. I don't know how Simon and Newman keep it up over the long haul. You wake up one morning feeling unaccountably cheerful, and there's a whole day's work gone. Where does this leave us? The McNeil-Lara NewsHour uses the word essayist for the people who do their more ruminative pieces, most likely because they can't bear to hear the people call commentators either. But I can't get over thinking that the essay's a written form, and I don't know that hearing yourself described as a language essayist would get you off the hook pretension-wise. So call me whatever you like, staff nitpicker, linguist in residence, or simply language guy. Or keep calling me a commentator if you must, and I'll try to live up to it. That's it for today, Terry. Back to you.
Okay, Jeff, I get the message. We'll work on it. Hey, sometime we can talk about how I hate being called the hostess of Fresh Air. Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto. Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers produced the interviews on Fresh Air. Our research interns are Andrew Kaplan and Liz Trubert. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we explore the secrets of the universe with physicist James Treffel. And we meet the writer and director of an obscure horror film called Carnival of Souls. George Romero and Rod Serling have credited the film for influencing them, and now the film is back in distribution. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.